The topic that they asked me to speak about was the relationship between poverty and education policy. Kind of a big topic.
How many hours are they giving you to talk about that?
They're giving me about 10 to 15 minutes.
Okay. So how did you decide what 90% to leave out?
Well, I'm going to start out with just a super brief history, basically just going back to the 1960s when the original Federal Education Act was passed. And Title I funds began to start flowing in order to provide some extra help for students in poverty. That would be 1965. And then just after that, a report came out called Equality of Opportunity by Coleman. It's really famous. And his main conclusion was that socioeconomics affects students much more than school does. And that really aggravated a lot of educators. What they took it to mean was school doesn't matter. You know, it just depends whether you have money or not. So for the next 20 or 30 years, folks have been trying to create what you might call effective schools. There was a whole movement called the Effective Schools Movement. And then the 2000s is when some of us started studying what you would call sort of break the mold schools, outliers, high poverty, high performing schools. You know, what magic formula are they using to succeed where most schools don't? Actually, the study that we did went on for several years. It was actually part of a national study, I think about 20 states, you know, looking at multiple years of test scores in multiple subjects and divided them into poverty groups. And then we looked within high poverty groups and said, who's outperforming everybody else? So we identified dozens of schools that were beating the odds. And so what they had found out was there's really, I'm going to say, five things that they do better than everybody else. One of them is they make sure that all of their local policies are geared towards student success. So if you can imagine a policy where, like, a three strikes and you're out policy, okay, you're tardy three times, you get suspended from school. That would be an example of a policy that's not exactly student-centered and trying to help.
Right.
It's more of a punishment type of policy. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see that the local school board policies in these districts don't have that kind of punitive flavor to them. And so everything is geared towards student success. When you talk about what's going on in the classroom, they align their curriculum, their teaching, and their testing so that you don't have silly things like trick questions on tests, you know, just to fool somebody. You don't have once and done. If you didn't learn it the first time, we can reteach you. It's not one chance and you're out. And when you grade the students, it's based on performance against the standards, not performance against other students. So you don't grade on a curve.
Okay.
The second is really having a hot shot staff, teachers, staff, leaders, lots of support for those people, like mentoring for new teachers, continuing education, you know, so professional development, whatever you want to call it, not a frill, it's a must. Allowing teachers time to plan together and look at their results and modify their lesson plans, so actually building that into the schedule, and terminating poor performing teachers early on. In other words, don't wait until they get tenure and then just deal with it. Really, really make sure that the people you're permanently hiring fit the culture and are doing a good job.
Okay, what else?
The third one is monitoring progress constantly. So these schools have really cool data systems. Now, these can be rural schools that don't have fancy computers, but they have methods to keep track of everything, not just test scores, but things like behavior, attendance, participation, performance demonstrations, extracurricular activities, just basically trying to know as much as they can about the students and looking at the data to drive improvements. The fourth finding was a lot of attention to both rewards and special interventions. So rewarding achievement and rewarding positive behavior happens all the time. You'll just see all kinds of celebrations of the good things that are happening. And so it really sets a good atmosphere of high expectations, but also recognition. A lot of interventions like one-on-one tutoring, small group. And in fact, the one thing that I think was really amazing that we saw in so many places were individual education plans for every student. And I know in special ed, they call those IEPs, mm-hmm. individual education plans, and they're usually only for special education students.
Right.
But if they work for those students and help to individualize the help that they get, then why not do it for everybody? Some of these are viewed as sort of elite frills, you know, that only the really rich schools can afford. But we saw these in places like Vienna. That's not exactly the ritziest place in Illinois. So, I mean, we saw this all over the place, and it was just basically saying each student is an individual. It's that student-centered thing again. And then the last finding, which we thought was probably the most important, was it was that student-centered, learning-centered business. But going along with that is no excuses. We are not going to allow these children to fail. We're not going to blame them. We're not going to blame their parents. We're not going to blame each other. We're just going to get the job done.
Time out. When you say no excuses, you don't mean the kids get no excuses. You mean the grown-ups have no excuses.
Right, right. We have no excuse if these children fail. If we have a 75% poverty school, we're not going to lower our expectations and blame poverty for the fact that these kids aren't doing well. We're just going to make sure they do well. And there's no more to it. I mean, it's just an amazing attitude that these folks had. And it was pervasive across the whole staff and the community. Lots of mutual trust, lots of holding each other accountable. And it's just sort of do whatever it takes. You know, whatever it takes, we're going to do it. We're going to pull out all the stops. And in fact, one of my colleagues called this the ethos of excellence, which I thought was pretty neat, you know. But just this total quality that we're good, the students are good, these are our students, we're not going to fail. The very last point I'm going to make is that, you know, when you talk about education policy, you know, I think it was Tip O'Neill, maybe, back in the day in the U.S. Congress, who said all politics are local. But I'm basically saying all policy is local. So you can have all kinds of laws and support coming from the state and federal government. But unless those policies actually affect behavior at the local level, they don't matter. Hence we have all these sort of failed national policies, you know, things that basically say, let's ratchet up the punishments and everybody will get better, or, you know, things like that. And those generally get ignored. So the most important policies to overcome poverty effects are those that happen at the district and the school and the classroom level and even the community level, because policy only makes a difference when it changes behavior and guides your actions. And so we have seen schools that have adopted these kind of policies and done those five main things, and they get better, and they do a great job. So, you know, after working at the state level in policy for many years, it just kind of gets frustrating to see how many, quote-unquote, silver bullets get passed, but things don't change, and they really do change at the local level.